Interview with Lieb Picard, April 16th, 2009, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. Great. Well, I want to start out with from the beginning, more or less, and get a little bit of your background in education and,
sure.
and where you went to school and how you got interested in securities type issues.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, if you want to start where I went to school, I went to Colgate University and then graduated from there, and then I went on to Harvard Law School.
Okay.
And
did you get any securities law when you were at Harvard Law School?
I had a course with Louis Loss, who's one of the prime participants in the securities process, but I took a corporation course from him.
Okay.
I would not suggest, however, that that had much to do with my getting involved with securities.
Well, take me to how you did get involved.
Well, the way you got involved with securities is after. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. After law school, of course, I needed a job, so I went to New York City and got a job with a law firm. There that dealt in banking and securities law matters. And I spent about 8 years in Wall Street.
Which firm was that?
Well, there were two firms. The first one was Seward and Kissel, S-E-W-E-R-D, Kissel, K-I-S-S-E-L-L. Mm-hmm. And then after 3 years there, I moved over to a law firm called Nixon, Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, Alexander, and Mitchell.
Okay. Heard of that one.
Nixon, Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, Alexander, and Mitchell. And I worked in the corporate department, and I would be involved in various aspects of the securities profession. Underwritings, acquisitions, mutual fund work, finance work. And there, of course, you're immersed in the securities, and you begin to learn a little bit about it. I say begin because it's a very complicated subject.
Right.
And some years there, as you probably might recall as a historian, Nixon was elected president of the United States, and Mitchell became the Attorney General.
Right.
And I worked with both of these gentlemen. Not as on a shoulder-to-shoulder level,
right.
Of course.
Right.
But I was an associate at the firm. And I was asked by one of the senior people at Mudge Rose if I was interested in going to work in Washington, because the then new chairman of the SEC, a gentleman by the name of William Casey, was looking for some expertise in his office in the securities field. And so I was asked if I wanted to get out, and I went down and I saw Bill Casey, interviewed with him, and Bill asked me at the time, about my background, asked me how long I would be able to stay there. And I told him 2 years. He said, that's fine, because that's all he was planning to stay as well. And, of course, I was there 6 years.
Right.
So events have a way of changing. So I came down, and I was Bill Casey's special assistant.
Right. What did he tell you your job was going to be as his special assistant?
Yeah, he told me at the time that he particularly needed support in the Investment Company Act area, the 40 Act area.
Okay.
We call it the 40 Act, the Investment
right.
Company Act. And I had some knowledge and expertise in that area, and I said, fine, I'd be glad to do what I can. And from the moment I arrived, I never got even near that subject. I had spent virtually all my time in the chairman's office dealing with matters relating to broker-dealers and financial responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the bulk of my work.
Yeah, I want to get a little bit of a sense of why that was. What was happening at this point, about 72, I guess, 70s?
Yeah, that's right, 71, 72. It's a good question.
What was coming together to create this overwhelming interest in this particular area?
Yeah, there was a number of it's a good question. There were a number of events in the financial sector which were driving the SEC to have to draw its attention to this. Among them were these. They had a paperwork crisis, which was unfolding in effect in the late 60s, where the street was just unable to process the transactional activity because of the cumbersome nature in which it was done, because of the volume, precipitous volume increases that were occurring, and the lack of systems to handle the transactional volume in a accurate and organized fashion. Mm-hmm. And there were examples of firms that had the papers piled up to the ceiling, mm-hmm. unable to determine, where a particular dividend was to be credited, or where the other side of the transaction was. Errors were prominent, and as a consequence, the NYSE suspended trading one day a week, mm-hmm. and I think it was a Wednesday when they closed. And on that day, the back office was to do everything they could to try to unclog the system. Okay, it was terrible. And not only that, there were a lot of losses that arose as a result of that and other circumstances.
And some firms went under as well.
Approximately 85 to 90 firms failed in the street. Most of them, a lot of them New York Stock Exchange member firms. And they were just unable to handle it. So the SEC was mandated and required to step in and to try to devise solutions to this problem.
So that was the biggest driver behind this.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Okay.
And we had a study. Another major event that I was involved in, and it's acknowledged in the study itself, is the study of unsafe and unsound practices of broker dealers.
Okay.
Which was issued, I believe, in 71 or 72. I have a copy of it someplace.
Okay.
The study of unsafe and unsound practices, and it was a heavily involved study by the staff of the SEC of what was the precipitating causes. Of this financial debacle, because it was a serious problem.
Did you work with market regulation people?
Yeah, market regulation wasn't in existence then.
Trading and markets.
Yeah, it was trading and markets, which was a combination of market reg and enforcement.
Okay.
So I worked very closely and worked with Ezra Weiss and Stan Sporkin and Herb Pollack and others on this study. And the study was a highly visible and regarded study that came out,
mm-hmm.
and it was had a series of recommendations for what should be done to address the problem. So I spent a lot of my time on that study, and the study was well received, and a lot of the recommendations were eventually, most of the recommendations were eventually implemented by the SEC. That was one of its great successes, because they came up with, out of that study came a new provision for net capital, a new provision for segregation and handling of customer funds by brokers, a reduction and elimination of the stock certificate as a recordation of ownership and transfer. In other words, the bookkeeping entry was embraced and pursued. Clearing systems were devised. Clearing and settlement systems were devised for the settlement of transactions. Transfer agents were regulated for the first time, and that was another major part of my effort as in the chairman's office and as director. Was the implementation of the transfer agent regulation. And the transfer agent regulation was was legislatively invoked. So we had a lot of in the process of doing all this. I had a lot of dealings with the Hill, in testimony on the Hill, on these topics.
Is this during the years after this period?
I guess this would be supportive of the commission when I was in the chairman's office and eventually actually doing it myself, mm-hmm. As director,
right.
With testifying before Congress numerous times on this issue of transfer agent regulation, because transfer mm-hmm. agents heretofore had never been regulated.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not sure if you know what a transfer agent is.
Vaguely.
Yeah, a transfer agent is either an entity or an affiliate of a company which records the ownership interest in the company. And kind of important, because you have to keep track of that. And that was an unregulated segment of the financial community. It is now regulated, and they have rules, they have turnaround rules, they have rules on recordations and things of that kind, which are on the books and which work very well. But again, that's one more segment that came out of this process. It's only one of many, however.
Mm-hmm. What was the response of the industry, of the New York Stock Exchange in particular, to some of these things?
The New York Stock Exchange tended to be protective of its own jurisdiction and turf, as you would expect. But they knew that something had to be done. And, of course, we had other burning issues, the New York Stock Exchange, other burning issues at the
right.
time, among them fixed commissions. That's a major event that occurred under my watch,
right.
The unfixing our competitive rates. But the New York Stock Exchange knew that there had to be improvements, and they were helpful in the improvements. I mean, the Depository Trust Company was in part, you know, of their doing. The Depository Trust being the vehicle today which houses most of the ownership.
Okay.
So that if you walk into a Bernie Madoff and you found that he says he has $25 million of IBM stock, you could confirm whether that stock is in DTC or not. And, of course, that wasn't done by the regulators.
Mm.
But it gives you an idea what DTC is all
okay.
about.
Yeah.
In other words, the brokers deposit their ownership interest in positions in DTC. And DTC records them, holds them in bookkeeping fashion.
Okay. So this was something that the SEC and the exchange worked on together.
That's right, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, the reason I ask is because a lot of these larger issues that yeah. clearly occupied a lot of your time later, you know, I have a pretty high profile, but some of the things you discuss here don't really show up that much.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
the implication is that things went pretty well on this, because it sounds like they were directly related to this back office crisis.
Yeah, things went well, but I mean they required a lot of attention, a lot of debate, public debate. The net capital rule, for instance, you know, how it should be structured, what
mm-hmm.
what should be the charges for particular positions, all were heavily debated.
Where?
Well, within the SEC and within the public, because normally the process for adopting these rules is to publish them for public comment.
Right.
And then for financial community and the public investors and the SEC to debate the efficacy of these positions and then come to a conclusion. So there was always enormous debate over this. There was debate, just to give you one example of what I'm talking about. because of the financial crisis, a lot of investors lost money. I mean, if these firms went under, the New York Stock Exchange had a fund which was supposed to reimburse them. But that fund was soon dissipated. And this is sort of a forerunner to SIPC, which you've heard about.
Mm-hmm.
That was another major event during this period, the creation of SIPC, which, as we know, insures customer funds and securities against defalcation and insolvency,
right.
up to approximately $500,000. But one reaction within the SEC, and this is an inside story, there are some principal people in the SEC who advised that brokers should no longer be able to hold directly customer cash. Now, I don't know whether I should name those people or not. Maybe I won't. I'm on the other side of the equation. But they wanted to take the cash away from the brokers and put it into banks, mm-hmm. so the brokers would leave that money in banks. Well, that has some serious implications to it, because if the brokers had to move their money to banks, then essentially they would no longer have it available necessarily to lend out to their customers on margin, as one example of something. Mm-hmm. Without having that, their revenue streams would be cut significantly, because you can look at the typical broker-dealer. If you cut out his margin, the revenues on margin, he's essentially underwater. So the question was, what could you do to address the issue of safety of customer funds, or the extreme of putting that money, requiring them to put that money into banks where they would essentially lose some control and mm-hmm. effort over it. So we came to a compromise, and this is the forerunner of Rule 15 C3-3, which is the customer fund and segregation rule, okay. which I was very heavily involved in drafting. Not only writing, it was a task force that the chairman put together. Chairman Casey, and the head of the task force was Jim Needham.
Okay.
And with Needham on the task force was myself, some people from the industry, securities industry. Mm-hmm. I believe either Stan Sporkin or Eric Pollack from the enforcement division. And there may have been one or two others.
Okay.
And we finally came up with Rule 15C33, which is a rule which permits the brokers to hold customer cash, but they have a strict accountability. It can be used for margin and maybe one or two other purposes, but it cannot be used in their trading activities. And that rule today is on the books. It's worked very well over the last 25, 30 years. And very little customer cash in the broker-dealer industry has ever been mm-hmm. lost.
Was enforcement ever a problem with that?
Yeah, enforcement wanted more strict measures.
Okay.
Yeah. So there would be a tension between enforcement and the market okay. and market regulation. The same thing goes for the net capital rule. The net capital rule, they wanted more strict provisions, and we tended my own position on this. It's different. My own position is essentially what the net capital rule is today.
Okay. So it sounds like there's a lot of tension going on between the idea of enforcing as much as practically possible and sort of letting the market work itself out.
Yeah. I think the enforcement division has as a primary goal, and it should, the protection of investors, and so they would want to make sure that any provision, that they're comfortable with any provision, and that there's maximum protection. Well, you can give maximum protection to investors, and you should, but that has to be balanced against the regulatory costs and other factors.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a point of debate throughout my tenure at the there would always be a different view, not right. always, but frequently a different view by the division of enforcement.
And where was Chairman Casey on this? Did he sort of did he set the tone?
I recall one day we were over there discussing before the Congress. This new rule, this new segregation cash rule. And one of the senators got up and said, "Mr. Casey, I'd like you to explain the way 15C33 works and what it does to protect investors." And I'm sitting behind him, of course, and suddenly this gray-haired guy turns around, look in the room, and I knew who he was looking at. I said, Mr. Picard, would you mind responding to this question? I mean, Bill was a, you know, as you can imagine, and it's true today of these commissioners. They don't want to get into the nitty-gritty
right.
of some of these financial protection rules because they're extremely complex, and they take an enormous amount of time, and you try to have confidence in the staff that they're doing the right thing at the right time.
Right.
So I think Bill certainly wasn't resistant to any of this. I don't think he wanted to lock the money up into banks because I think he was getting pressure from the industry not to do that. And I think we found a compromise that worked for everybody. So that was just one microcosm of one example of the battles that we would constantly have within the division as to the right balance, the right approach to regulation, and how far we should go.
Now, and you're working as an advisor to the chairman at this point. Were you working? Who was in market regulation or trading in markets?
Well, the head was Irv Pollack.
Okay.
Yeah, and he headed up not only trading, at that time, the division of, I guess it was trading, I forgot what it's called, Ken. It might have been trading the markets. But he headed up both the regulation and the enforcement. And, of course, Casey reorganized.
Right.
During my tenure up in his office, Casey reorganized the SEC, split the enforcement division and the regulation in two parts, which I think has some wisdom behind it because there's conflicting provisions on enforcement versus regulation. I remember once, this is sort of superficial, but we had some provision up there saying it on a rule which we were proposing before the SEC, which started out by saying the following practices should be adhered to by broker-dealers. And Stan Sporkin got up and says, I wanted to read, it shall be unlawful to engage in this type of activity. And somebody said, well, why do you have to have a read that? He says, because I want to tell a judge, you know, when the person hasn't been abiding by this provision, that it's unlawful and it's right in the law. So there is this constant conflict between the enforcement provision.
And it sounds like the conflict was there within the one division when you had trading and markets, when you had enforcement and the market regulation together.
Yeah. The conflict
so
was
Casey
there.
Casey is essentially separated
to a and I think for better.
Okay.
And it's still that way today. Right. Now maybe Chairman Shapiro will look at that again, but I don't think that is in the cards.
Okay.
So.
Then Brad Cook came in.
Yep.
Did you continue in an advisory role working directly with him?
Well, what happened is Brad Cook was general counsel under Bill Casey, I think Brad Cook was appointed the first director of the Division of Market Regulation.
All right, that sounds right.
And Bill asked me, I was the 2 years was up, and Bill said, he said, can you drive with me to Baltimore? And he was going up there for some to catch a plane in the limousine. He wanted to talk to me, and he didn't have time to do it in the office. So I was supposed to ride up in the limousine with him and confer about my future. And then I get ship shuttled back. You know, my time was not as valuable as his.
Of course.
And he said, Lee, I want you to become associate director of trading, of market regulation in charge of financial responsibility. You've been doing it for 2 years, and you're right in the middle of this, and we think you're the ideal candidate. And I said, okay, I would do it. And then he left shortly thereafter. Sometime thereafter. And Brad Cook was my boss because Brad was director.
Right.
And then when Casey left, Cook was appointed chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I was designated as director.
So you were only associate director for a fairly short period of time.
I would say 8 months, 7 to 8 months, maybe a year, I can't remember, something like that.
Some things that happened in this period. you had things like the future structure statement, white paper on market structure. Tell me a little bit about those projects.
Those projects can emanate out of the issue of commissions, that is, fixed commissions.
Okay.
Because there was a sense that the fixed commission structure, fixed rates of commissions, which were set by the New York Stock Exchange and indirectly approved by the SEC, wasn't working. Institutional investors were finding ways to circumvent the fixed rate structure because it was uneconomical. Bigger trades just didn't cost that much more to do than small trades. And so economics was prevailing, and the market was starting to fragment. That is, at least in the perception of some, was fragmenting, because firms would go to regional, institutions would go to regional exchanges, which could have a better method of trading and at a lower cost, ultimately. Rebates were prevalent, give-ups were prevalent. It was a leaky sieve. You know, it wasn't working right, and economics were prevailing over regulation, which is regulatory dictating of the fixed rate commissions.
Mm-hmm.
So we started doing these studies of the markets and the fragmentation, whether or not fragmentation was detrimental to the markets. And one can argue, some argue that it is. I personally don't believe fragmentation is a serious issue. Never has been, never mm-hmm. will be. The SEC spent an enormous amount of energy on an issue which I don't think amounts to a hill of beans.
Yeah, I mean, the question would be fragmentation. Another way you could talk about that is competition. You've got different...
Right.
markets.
Exactly. And competition's almost, in order to eliminate fragmentation, you got to eliminate competition.
Was the understanding, though, that you would seek to foster this unified market?
That's right, exactly. There was not only an understanding, but a mandate out of the Securities Act amendments in 1975 that you foster a more, a situation in which every investor could get the best possible price available wherever that price might be, whether it's in the third market, the fourth market, on an electronic system, whether it's on the exchange floor. How highly unrealistic type things for the government to be involved in.
But we haven't gotten to the 75 Act amendments.
No, but we're getting there.
And I'm just wondering where the guiding hand came during this period, this 72-73 period, when you're issuing these statements, and the assumption is that you want to have a non-fragmented market.
That's the assumption. That is the assumption. And it's whether it's a proper assumption or not, we can debate that.
Was it something the chairman was interested in particular? Was there a sense that this was what Congress wanted?
I think there were people at the SEC who felt that that was a proper approach, that fragmentation was detrimental to the to some investors.
Okay.
Where else would it come from? That's a good question. It came from the New York Stock Exchange because it's in their economic interest to make sure that they maintain order flow on their floor, and I think that's the primary thrust. And the Stock Exchange was able to convince some people at the Commission that this was a primary goal of our nation to have unified markets.
How much input did they have in your deliberations when you're putting together these papers?
They were primary. Well, there were hearings these papers were exposed for public comment, so obviously they had tremendous input, and they spent a lot of their energy. You can imagine the amount of energy the New York Stock Exchange spent on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't they? I mean, they're specialists on the floor. We had committees that I was involved in, the Central Market Committee, and we had a national picturing the name of this commission. Let's see. There was a national SEC's National Advisory Committee on the Implementation of a Central Market System.
National Market Advisory Board or whatever
it was. It was called the National Advisory Committee on the Implementation of a Central Market System.
Okay.
And I was a member of that committee, and so were senior people in the street. The senior people, I'm talking about Felix Royden.
Right.
And people of that type.
Right.
All of whom had, in my opinion, a vested interest in this process. Not directly apparent, but I mean they spent their life with people who were in the financial community and mm-hmm. who were instrumental in the specialists on the floor and things of that type. So the notion was the SEC in combination with the industry was to be the architects of a central market system,
right,
where there'd be integration of quotations, integration of clearing systems. And that was a goal that was promulgated and eventually evolved in, from the 75 Act amendments.
Right.
Was it a useful exercise? I'm of the opinion it was not, but I was overruled in many cases on that.
By the
course of
the
events.
The commission course of events.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was not a regulatory type, and somebody once said to me, you know, Lee, you're sitting in that chair as director, but you don't believe in, you're not a firm believer in regulation. And I said, that's true. All the more reason for me to be here. But you know, in some areas I was more vigorous. In the financial area, I wanted a strong financial base,
mm-hmm.
and I did what I could.
Things like the net capital.
The net capital rule, okay. The segregation rule, clearing and settlement. We eventually ended up with systems which are extremely efficient in terms of clearing and settlement. We don't have these paperwork debacles that we had before.
Something that pops up is some controversy. And you talked about institutional investors. There was a Rule 19b-2, and there was some question as to whether institutional investors could have seats on the exchange.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about where that conflict, that controversy came from, and how it was dealt with?
Well, these institutions seeking seats on the exchange would be an indirect way of recapturing some of these fixed commissions. Again, that's an issue relating to fixed commissions.
Okay.
And if they had seats on the exchange, presumably they could trade for their managed accounts, and they could rebate back some of the commissions because they would have essentially captured them. Okay. So there was this notion they shouldn't have seats on exchanges, which is kind of crazy. But again, it's to patch up and to hold in place that fixed commission rate. Now, 19b-2 was the rule which related to having, if you remember, having to trade on the floor of the exchange. I'm trying to reconstruct that. It was, I think, at one point referred to as Rule 394. And that rule required that a member of an exchange bring the trades to the floor.
Right, that's the New York Stock Exchange rule.
Well, 19b-2 eroded that and started to cut away and say you can no longer compel your membership to bring the trades to the floor. They can trade where... there was an exception. There's always an exception they could go to a regional exchange.
Right.
But they couldn't trade upstairs in their own trading department. And that rule, eventually the 394 rule was deemed to be anti-competitive. And I think Rule 19b-2 was the rule which decided that to be the case.
Okay.
And that made lots of sense. We've always thought that the New York Stock Exchange should not have a rule which compelled its membership not to be able to trade upstairs if it so chose. And so that rule, they were compelled to eliminate this anti-competitive rule.
It took a long time, though.
It took a long time. And you know, well, it's because the New York Stock Exchange put up a serious, stiff fight mm-hmm. on this issue. They thought it was central to their survival, which it turned out to be not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another example of a rule of the NYC, which turned out to be unnecessary for their well-being.
And
fixed commissions would be another example of that.
Right. Before we get deeply into some of those things surrounding the 75 Act, one other area I want to touch on is the rise of options trading.
Right.
And how your office in particular, because you're right there at the point at which this is emerging, and how you responded to that.
Well, the enforcement division was always very, very skeptical about option trading. We looked at it for a number of years, and we slowly but surely phased it in. And we were convinced by the option exchanges that what they were doing had financial safety behind it. And we had no reason to believe that it wasn't permissible.
Why was enforcement concerned about it?
I think they were worried about the manipulative intent that could occur because of option trading. And I think it was a process that took some time, but we were eventually convinced, or satisfied, I should say, I don't want to use convinced, that the process was not anathema to investors, and was a process which investors wanted desperately for their hedging purposes and for other economic reasons.
Do you remember having discussions with the people in Chicago?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we had extensive discussions.
Amex, I guess, was...
Yeah, Amex one. Another. Yeah, well, what happened, of course, CBOE got in first, and they were very successful, and then other exchanges wanted to rapidly follow. So there was constant pressure on us to approve this as quickly as possible. That was one of the big... I remember that being a prominent part of the equation.
What would you say back? What would your... You know, if you're going to impose conditions, what were they?
I can't recall exactly what conditions we... Well, I mean, we did impose conditions. As I say, it was a phase-in process, and we watched it carefully before we would permit full expansion. But I can't recall... I mean, there were conditions about financial safety, things of that type.
Okay. Had it gone, in the time you were there, it had definitely, Amex had started with options. Had the New York Stock Exchange begun?
No, I think that came after I...
Okay.
But the other exchanges came in. Philadelphia came in, of course.
Okay, yeah, right.
And others.
And later on, there was a freeze for a while. After your time as well, I think.
Could have been, I don't know.
Okay.
And then, of course, another major program that was launched during my tenure was the oversight of municipal securities firms.
Talk about that a little bit.
The municipals have largely been exempt, and they are exempt even as we speak today from the 33 Act provisions. Mm-hmm. But it was thought that there should be some regulatory oversight of municipal securities broker-dealers. So they were required to register, and they were required to adhere to a series of standards. And because municipals are not only dealt with by broker-dealers but also by banks, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board was put into effect, which is an amalgam of broker-dealers and banks, and it sets standards subject to SEC approval. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of it's like a FINRA, like a self-regulatory organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole program was unfolded, and it set standards for municipal transactional activities. There was markup provisions, there was confirmation provisions, record-keeping provisions, the same type of standards and measures applicable to broker-dealers dealing in equities and debt were set forth for broker-dealers to deal with municipals, with the public.
I would assume there would be some pushback from them on that.
There was some, but it worked out fine. I don't remember being. Yeah, of course there would always be pushback. That's a common theme. Okay, yeah, among securities firms, and rightly so. They should be. They should be. It's like today with the investment advisors. You know, this notion that they should be under FINRA. Well, they're going to push back,
right?
Because they don't. Regulation is a costly affair.
With the municipal securities, did economics, the problems that cities were facing in the 70s, did that have anything to do with
it? I think it did. Yes, it did. It has something to do with the regulation of that industry.
Because when things get in stress, that's right. When the problems
exactly.
show up.
Okay. Stress tends to create more regulation.
Okay.
It never reduces regulation.
Well, let's get into commission rates then.
All right. That was probably one of the biggest events on my watch.
Yeah, and under Casey and Brad Cook, there was something that someone dubbed prudent gradualism, i.e. you're going to unfix the rates on transactions mm-hmm. above $500,000, things like
right,
that.
Right, right.
Do you remember that decision being made, or was that ad hoc?
It was systematically made. I think we reduced it, one of the reasons for the gradualism is to see what occurs
okay.
when you have at least some measure of competition among transactional activity. What are the results? So it wasn't a bad idea. And
did you see what occurred?
What occurred was a relatively smooth operation. Not anything of any significance. Now, commission rates eventually came down tremendously, but the profitability of the street wasn't commensurate with the reduction in commission rates. In fact, profitability eventually went to even higher levels as the street found, I guess through either greater volume, there was a tremendous increase in volume throughout this period. Mm-hmm. Trading volume, and
right.
that trading volume had an impact on their profitability.
So you saw this even in this period when the rates were unfixed only for the very large
That's right.
transactions.
We saw this. We didn't see any negative consequences that were predicted by the New York Stock Exchange and others. The unfixing of commission rates is probably one of the major acts of deregulation the government has ever been involved in. Other than the Civil Aeronautics Board.
Was the intention to continue going, working that way, to continue gradually
yes.
going down?
Gradually, eventually. Well,
what happened? Because it seems like it kind of stopped in the Brad Cook
Well,
year.
It didn't stop because we finally did. In May of 75, we
right.
did. Right, okay.
Until 75,
yeah.
when all the reins were on.
Well, you're saying there was a period of time when it was quiescent?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
There was the issue was prominent and debated intensively during all this period.
Right.
And at some point, and the commission did it. The commission's convened, I think it was under Ray Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had five chairmen while I was director. Casey, Cook, Garrett, Rod Hills, and then finally Harold Williams. I have five of them. And you're saying my tenure was short at the SEC. I had five chairmen under while I was director.
It's true.
And
did Garrett? Was it clear that Garrett was committed to unfixing commission rates?
I think Garrett was a very prudent and conservative type chairman. But he became convinced, as I did, that commission rates were fixing. Commission rates were not only unjustified, but the SEC didn't have the capacity to be able to determine whether the rates were reasonable.
Mm.
We didn't really have it, and we were. Periodically, the NYSE would come in with a new schedule of rates, and usually higher, of course. And we would get out our Ouija boards and try to figure out what to do, and usually come up with an approval process, but not not having a verifiable, dependable way of doing it. Because there wasn't any. I mean, it's a service that's rendered.
Right.
And there used to be notions that institutions were subsidizing individuals were subsidizing institutions, but you couldn't establish that, and I'm not sure it was relevant to anything.
And the sense is that, you know, the New York Stock Exchange is going to be basically resist all of this.
Yeah.
But Robert Hack, for one, at least, seemed to have a sense that this was going to happen in one way or another. Did you work with him much or talk to him?
He was. I think had a broad perspective on this and realized that the inevitable. Result would be the unfixing of commission rates, and he was one of the enlightened regulators that we worked with, and I think he did a credible job.
In what way would you have worked with him?
Well, he would be down to chat with us and talk with us about what he saw are the implications of our action of unfixing commission rates.
Okay,
and we would debate the issue with him and discuss it. We had a lot of meetings and hearings on this topic.
And at some point, the meetings and hearings started to go to Capitol Hill when you start talking about the 75 Act amendments.
That's right. Right. Yeah, it's interesting that the 75 Act amendments have a provision in the effect that the rates on commission rates on exchanges should be competitive. Well, that was enacted by the Congress 2 or 3 months after the SEC officially unfixed rates.
Yeah. Locking the door.
Yeah, locking. That. I guess locking the door. But on the other hand, maybe before the horse got out of the barn. I don't know. It was a little late in the equation for their courageous act, which was already done.
Was there? What was your role in this? Yeah, it was the May 1st, 75, I guess. Was it just another day, or was there a lot of work leading up to this to watch closely what happened?
Well, as I recall, we had had hearings again on market structure and commission rates, and. It became a topic which was on the SEC's agenda, and we went up there and on this particular time. I think it was the actual SEC official act was before May 1st. I think we set it for May 1st.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly how much earlier it was, but the commission met, and we debated the issue for a very short period of time, and all five commissioners voted to unfix commission rates. And I went downstairs after that and talked with the Division of Enforcement and told them that had occurred because I knew that they were pushing that themselves for some period of time. And I think I spoke with maybe even Irv Pollack about it because Irv had so much to do with the hearings and with the debate on this before he lost part of his division to Brad Cook.
Right.
And he was, he was interested in hearing about that because he had had so much involvement in the process.
Okay. During this period, who were your key people in Division of Market Regulation? Who were you working with?
Well, the key people, in addition to myself, were Sheldon Rappaport.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Snodgrass, who was my associate director, so was Sheldon.
Right.
Dan Polaro, who's deceased, well, so was Sheldon. And Tony Newland, Newland, who was sort of in charge of clearing the settlement under my direction. John Lifton.
Okay.
I don't know, you've heard of those names.
Right? Yeah, I actually talked to John Lifton. Did you give you hinted that Tony Newland, for example, you gave him one particular thing.
That's right.
Is that how this worked? Is you would say, yeah, here's your portfolio, yeah, take this and deal with
it. Yeah, yeah. Each one has a subject matter that he concentrates in.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
So. Was that pretty much standard procedure?
Yeah.
The SEC.
In regular enforcement, I don't know how they carve up the piece, but in market regulation, you normally have, an area like Marty Moskowitz was another key player here. I mean, Marty was in charge of the oversight of these CBOE rule changes,
okay,
and the options. And Marty's deceased as well, I think. It's amazing.
Yeah. Again, of course, it gets back to your point that these are extremely complicated subjects.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to master all of them.
No, they're extremely complex.
Okay. Well, the last big subject matter I have is the whole central market thing, and we've talked a bit about that.
Right.
But, of course, it seems like that's the central to what the 75 Acts amendments were about, at least one of the big themes.
Yes, they are. It's a major theme that's carried forth for years and years to come, as they try to integrate the transactional process.
And you had earlier talked about this advisory committee on the central market system.
It right.
It was run by somebody named Yearly.
Yeah, Yearly.
Alexander
Yearly. Sandy Yearly.
Okay. What was he in the commission?
No. He was a head of Robinson Humphrey.
Okay.
Which is a regional broker-dealer firm.
Okay.
And we were trying to come to a conclusion as to what should be done in terms of market structure. How do the players fit in? How do the specialists fit in? How do the third market firms fit in? How do the institutional players, that is the institutional money managers, are coming on stream? You got to remember, Ken, these institutional money managers were expanding and becoming more prominent as the years gone on. And as you can see, they dominate today.
Right.
The advisors, there weren't so many hedge funds then, but there were investment advisors with large amounts of money under their management.
Mm-hmm.
And, Fidelity was there then, Putnam was there. They're all the big firms. And here they were moving this money around. And in a sense, providing the same kind of liquidity, the same sort of participation that a Goldman Sachs or a Morgan Stanley might be participating.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do these players get integrated? And where are the problems, And we've met repeatedly on these issues. And as I say, the fundamental defects in this whole deliberative process is, first of all, whether or not you needed it, and secondly, can you bring a bunch of competitors into a room, specialists in them, and expect them to really come out with anything that's subjectively useful?
Mm-hmm. Well, could you?
No. The answer is, I think not. I think the thing, nobody's ever done a story on this, but I think the thing was a failure. I think the subsequent action of the SEC has been largely a failure. Mm-hmm. In terms of the markets today are strong and are vibrant and are efficient, but not because of what the SEC has done.
Right.
At least in the area of structuring. The SEC is most successful has been in the area of policing, in the area of confidence and honesty in the markets, the area of insider trading, making sure that there they shine. But the SEC, in my opinion, does not shine when it tries to tell members that they've got to take an order and expose it to six other markets before they can do the transaction. I don't think that's necessary.
Yeah.
The SEC is also strong in the areas of disclosure. And what they've done with the markets in the disclosure area has been very successful. For instance, the last sale information, that was all done on our watch. That is, any transaction in an equity security of any magnitude has to be reported at the tape within 90 seconds. doesn't matter whether it's traded on the New York Stock Exchange, the Philadelphia Exchange, over the counter, upstairs at Merrill Lynch's trading desk, it has to be reported. Mm-hmm. Okay? There's the integration you're looking for. The same thing goes with quotations. If you're doing a bid or an offer, which is different from the last sale, and you're doing that in one location or another, it has to be integrated into a composite form. Again, a success of the SEC.
Composite tape.
A composite screen.
Okay.
Not a tape. A tape is for the last sale information.
Okay.
So you know, in the other deliberative process, you know, that this Central Market System Committee did, I don't think we accomplished a great deal.
Okay. The idea was you had
specialists fighting with Don Wheaton, who's a third market firm, as to, you know, what should be the regulation. And you can imagine what the regulation was of each of them was. It depended upon what was in their back pocket.
Right.
That's the way it acted, and that's only natural.
Right. I mean, supposedly the idea was to get everybody together and come up with a vision of what this central market would look like.
Well, you know, one of them was that it ought to be a black box. And as somebody said, well, why is it called black? Why isn't it red, white, and blue with stars on it? But, you know, we don't have black boxes, and I don't think we ever will, because we do have competitive markets. So you have inconsistencies in the 75 Act.
So that's the idea of a hard club.
Yeah, a hard club, right. Yeah, you've got the terminology.
And you got, you know, I guess you got lots and lots of ideas, people telling you what this thing
exactly
ought to look like.
That's right.
What did you do with those ideas?
Well, I mean, we distilled them, and we came up with, as I say, we came up with the last sale, transactional reporting.
Did that come out of these discussions?
I think it was in the process of being invoked and done as we deliberated.
Okay.
We came up with the notion that if you're going to be disseminating bids and offers, they ought to be consolidated, and they ought to be available so that anyone can readily get this information. We came up with clearing systems, which central clearing systems have settled these transactions. And we came up with strong financial responsibility rules for participants, which is something, you know, under my watch that we did, so that those who are participating in the process, those professionals, are not going to default on the transactions. Those are the fundamental tenets for a good market. And, of course, you know, we've got the enforcement division trying to make sure that that there's the manipulations and the insider trading are reduced to a minimum.
Mm-hmm. These things you talked about, do these fall under the category of quote rules?
Yeah, quote rules, last sale transaction rules, that's right.
Okay. Things like that, again, it would strike me that they would have been less controversial because they're not challenging anybody's turf. Was that the case?
Well, there would be discussions about that, particularly in the quote rules. You know, some would say that, you know, why should the quotes in our system be available for an outsider who hasn't paid for them?
Okay.
Things of that kind. There would be fundamental issues there.
Like the New York Stock Exchange wouldn't want NASDAQ to...
That's right.
But you were able to just step in and say, well, this is how it's going to be.
Yeah, that's right, in certain ways. That's right.
How much time and energy was consumed during this period when Congress is studying and thinking about the 75 Acts amendments?
Enormous amounts of time. Our division was just fully occupied with the 75 Act amendments. They took up months of time, and there was tremendous controversy over it. Like, just to give an example, one of the things in the fixed commission rate area, the industry wanted as a quid pro quo, they wanted Section 28E, which is an area that I deal with a lot, involving soft dollars.
Okay.
And so that rule, that law had to be argued and debated. That is, it gave fiduciaries the right to pay up for research,
right,
without violating ERISA. In other words, use commissions to obtain research, which otherwise they might not have been able to do. And that was a compromise or a quid pro quo for the repercussions or the consequences of unfixing commission rates. But there were a lot of things like that that had to be dealt with, you know, as measures, as the markets changed and evolved.
Did you get in discussions with particular senators, congressmen, or anything like that?
Yeah.
Harrison Williams, for example.
Yeah, Harrison Williams. Harrison Williams used to ask us to come over and testify all the time. He would always ask us to raise our hands and swear under oath that we were telling the truth. In the meantime, he was in the back office taking money from the Arabs. Mm. But
another story.
Yeah, that's yeah. another story. But yeah. that, that I was always somewhat amused by his strong sense of integrity. You know, whatever yeah. we had to raise our hands. Of course, if you know when you testify before these congressional groups, you're more or less under oath, whether you know it or not. And mm-hmm. and if you tell an untruth, you're subject to liability. So you don't have to raise your hand. But he dramatized it by asking us to raise our hands and say that we were under oath. Mm-hmm. I guess he didn't trust the staff of the SEC or something like that.
So you said that most of your staff was involved in this. Would the legislators come and say, you know, we want you to develop some ideas around this. Give it to us and we'll do something with it.
Yeah,
how did
yeah,
that work?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were people over on the Hill, a lot of ex-SEC staffers who were drafting this kind of legislation. And they would want support from our staff in drafting, and we would.
Okay.
And we would supply them with statutory provisions. In fact, probably I'd say 75% of the laws which were passed in 1975 were probably codified in our division.
Okay.
You know, they were, because we have the, you know, we presumably have the resources and the skill to do that, and subject to their review, of course. But so we would constantly get requests for drafting of pieces of legislation.
Was there ever any chance that Rule 394 would be wrapped into that? That
394, which is
yeah.
the provision which required, there was serious thought given to that. You know, but but the SEC, the NYSE managed to dodge that bullet for the moment. Eventually, they lost the battle, but they kept the 394 in place for some period of time.
Right,
and.
Why was it just the stock exchange
well,
just adding a big lever?
No, they had a compelling argument, you know, that, you know, if you don't bring it all to the floor, you don't get the, you know, you're bringing it to the floor and 85% of all the transactional activity in these listed securities occurring on the floor. Why shouldn't you bring it to the floor where it gets exposure to best trading activity possible?
Okay.
It's a compelling argument, you know.
Okay.
And the argument against it would be, well, you know, you're a private organization. Why should you be able to force any of your members to bring their business to your floor? Why can't they bring it any place they want? So these two were in tension. And it's another example of something that, you know, isn't clear on its face, but eventually it became obvious that 394 was antiquated, unnecessary, and anti-competitive.
Okay.
So we got rid of it. But it took some debate and some time.
Were you mostly involved in the last couple of years of your tenure as Director of Market Regulation? Were you mostly involved in dealing with the repercussions of this legislation?
Yes, we were.
What were some of those?
Well, I think one of the things they wanted us to do was to look at all SRO rules, SRO, self-regulatory organization rules, and determine whether they were any competitive or in the best interest of investors. So we had an enormous number of studies we had to do on that score. And, I mean, the last couple of years, I was only director for, 3.5 years, so a lot of things occurred after the 75 Act amendments that became, you know, the more intense of trying to figure out what the market structure should look like.
Mm-hmm.
So that became a heavier burden on us as well. Not that we made great progress, but that was a heavy burden.
Right. Were there any studies carried on that were as as ambitious as the one you did just before this advisor committee on the single market system.
I don't remember, Ken, whether we had any other studies. We're always doing studies, but I can't remember. I don't recall during the last stages that we had any, other than this massive review we had of the self-regulatory organization rules.
Did you have the staff to do all this, or were you ever stretched?
I'm always a great believer in not having too much staff. I mean, I remember Rod Hills would have Monday morning 8 o'clock meetings in his office, and the directors were all there, and he said, what are the staffing needs, you know? And I remember Stan Sporkin saying, well, you know, this, we're understaffed. We've got so many 1,500 people working here. He says, what we got to do is have a program where we go from every year 20% increase, so that at the end of 4 or 5 years we double the size of our organization where we can handle the volume. And Rod turned to me and said, what do you think, Lee? And I said, I think we've got to have a program similar to that, only going in the other direction. I think there were enough staff people there to help process. I mean, there was a lot of hard work to do, but I'm not a great believer in spending public money. Mm-hmm. So I don't subscribe to the notion that we're understaffed.
Any you talked about some of these initiatives that took place under your watch in these last couple of years, 76, 77. Did any of those initiatives take place, or were you mostly sort of catching up with all these studies and things? It sounds like most of the changes you made came a little earlier.
Yeah.
Some of the quote rules perhaps came out after the 75.
They did. The quote rules came out. I'm not sure they came out on my watch.
Okay.
And then what we did have is a lot of activity in terms of transfer agent regulation, which is somewhat prosaic. We had a lot of rules relating to municipal securities regulation.
Okay.
Which was kept us extremely busy. Then the option markets kept us very busy. So, you know, you combine that with the reviews we had, the SROs, we had a heavy-duty plate of activities.
Well, by this time, you'd outstayed your 2 years by a good bit.
Yeah, that's right.
What was behind your decision to move on from there?
Well, I think what happened is that I had been director for about 3 years, and it's Carter got elected president, and I think there was a notion that and he appointed Harold Williams, and there was a notion that they wanted to perhaps have somebody else as director of the mm-hmm. division.
Or did you get that the message from someone, or was there just a sense that you weren't going to fit in the new structure?
Well, the chairman and I talked about it, the new chairman, mm-hmm. and he decided he was going to try to find somebody else.
Okay.
And I said, fine.
Which is his prerogative, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. So did you go right into private practice after that?
Essentially. Yeah.
Okay.
Started my own law firm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you've been working in the securities area ever since?
I represent about 150 broker-dealers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything that we haven't talked about that
probably
we should get out? Well, there's probably a lot that should be in the record, things that stand out in your mind as having been colorful, instructive, or just interesting.
Yeah. It's a very challenging position. being the head of that division. Because the issues are very complex. The people you deal with, you know, there's a highly educated, informed group over at the SEC. They attract good talent, and the constituents, the outside group, are also, you know, highly informed, intelligent people. So there's never a day when you don't have a challenging and provocative type experience, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate to be able to be a director at that time, because there were so many major events that occurred. I mean,
right.
It was just, you know, industry-wide tumultuous things that were occurring.
One of those deals when the years seem to go by faster than they really do.
They really went by quickly, you know. And I was fortunate to have a lot of very strong people in my division. I mean, we had some extremely talented people. And you know, you can't do it alone.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's,
right.
It's an impossible task. You need people there to give you guidance and support. And so.
Well, terrific.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you taking some time and giving me a little guidance on this.
Good. Okay.
All right.